Judges 14 then, carrying on this look at the life of Samson. Judges 14. Now, I don't know if any of you children here like riddles. I give you some riddles, and if you can work out the answer to this, you can shout them out for me. Should we do a couple? Here's the first one. What has to be broken before you can use it? Any ideas? What has to be broken before you can use it? Shall I tell you? It's an egg. Okay. Here's the next one. What goes up, but it never comes back down? I don't know who said it, but you, there you go. Yeah, somebody thought about this. Yeah, your age goes up, but it never comes back down. Judges is all about riddles in Judges 14, at least. It's building up to the centerpiece of the chapter, which is Samson's riddle that he gives. So it's building up to the riddle. Then it's the riddle itself, and then the story after that focuses on his wife's desperate attempt to get the answers to the riddle, and then the very bloody aftermath of what happens when she betrays him. So it's a chapter all about riddles. And related to that, it's a chapter about telling secrets as well. Who's going to be told the secrets, and who won't be told secrets here? Who is Samson going to tell, and who is Samson going to hide them from? And one of the sad things in this chapter is that Samson conceals secrets from his own Israelite family, from the very people he should be ready to talk to, and so on, and he reveals secrets to the pagan Philistines. So it's all about riddles and secrets. And then there's another repeated phrase we're meant to notice here. In fact, there's a couple. You're meant to notice, I think, that the word tell or to tell is 14 times in the chapter, so that's all about telling secrets. But there's another one, which is went down. So you find went down in verse 1, verse 5, verse 7, verse 10, and verse 19. And it is true to say that in those events, when it says he went down, Samson is actually going down geographically. He's at a high point and he's going down in that sense. But it's also true to say that Samson in this chapter is on a moral descent as well. And you know, the Bible often uses, it often picks up on geographical descents to make a point about how someone is going downhill morally as well. If you want another example of that, it's Jonah. Jonah, at the beginning of the book, he went down to Joppa. But he wasn't just going down physically, he was running from God. He's trying to escape. He doesn't want to go to Nineveh. Well, it's the same thing with Samson here when he's going down. See, Samson has a very similar calling to Jonah. For Samson, it's his Nazarite calling. We talked about him being a Nazarite last week, that there were certain things he wasn't able to do. That as a lifelong Nazarite, he wouldn't drink of the fruit of the vine, he was to abstain, that no razor would go across his head, so his hair would need to grow, that he wasn't able to touch a dead body, because he's a Nazarite. He's got this lifelong calling. He's been set apart. He's not something he chooses to do. He's got it from birth, and he's got it for the whole of his life. And this is a chapter about Samson refusing to accept and live out his Nazarite calling. He simply doesn't want to do it. And throughout this chapter, we're going to see lots of ways in which he doesn't live out as a Nazarite should be living, and he's running from his calling. So I'm going to give you a list of 8 things Samson does in this chapter to run from his Nazarite calling. And then we're going to follow that up with one main lesson. I know sometimes when people say a high number of points, people panic. Don't worry. Yes, it's 8, but it's okay. That doesn't mean it's 3 times the length of a normal sermon or anything like that. 8 things Samson's willing to do to run from his Nazarite calling. Here's the first one. Verses 1 and 2. Samson is willing to pursue a Philistine woman based solely on lust. A Philistine woman, but it's all about lust. See, in those first couple of verses, I wish I could describe it as a romantic encounter, but it really isn't. In that opening verse, he doesn't take her out for dinner, he doesn't come home raving about her erudite conversation and her sparkling wit and her great sense of humour. Actually, we're told he just saw her. And in verse 2, he comes back again and it's the same thing. I have seen a woman. So this is purely physical. That's all that's going on here for Samson. So he goes back in verse 2 and he says to his parents, get her for me as a wife. This reminds me of, I think it was when I was little, I think I remember going to a restaurant once. It might have been a supermarket, but I think it was a restaurant where there was a tank of lobsters and you could choose, as they were all swimming around in the tank, which lobster you wanted for your dinner. And you don't spend time getting to know the lobster's personality, you just point at which one you want and that's what you're having for your dinner. For Samson here, it's just, get me that one. I want her. It's, you know, there's no time getting to know her or anything like that. And actually, the whole story as it unfolds is meant, I think, to remind us of an incident in Genesis 34. And it's a really horrific incident, but there are lots of similarities. Genesis 34 is where a man named Shechem goes and violates Jacob's daughter, Dinah. And you know, it's the same language. It says Shechem saw her, he took her, and he lay with her. Same thing again. And then do you know what he does after that? He goes back to his father, Hamor, and he says to Hamor, get me this young woman as a wife. It's exactly the same thing. But you see the point. You'd expect something like that from Shechem, this pagan man. You'd expect, but this is Samson. This is the one that God's chosen to deliver Israel. And here he is, pursuing a young woman as a piece of meat. That's what he's doing. He pursues her based on lust. Secondly, he's willing to do is he's willing to ignore his parents and marry a Philistine woman. That's verses 3 and 4. So verse 3, Samson's parents raise this objection. Aren't there any nice young Jewish girls? Why don't you marry one of them? Do you really have to go and pursue a woman from the Philistines? I think they probably needed to be much firmer than that. I think what they could have said was, this is wrong. God's told us we mustn't marry Canaanites. But nevertheless, they're raising a good objection. But Samson just ignores them. He says in verse 3, get her for me, for she pleases me well. And do you know what he literally says? That phrase, pleases me well, what he literally says here is, she seems right in my eyes. Now, I don't know if that phrase rings any bell for you. Right in my eyes. Because it's exactly the same phrase you get right at the end of Judges. Judges 21 verse 25, the final verse. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Samson is physically doing what is right in what he can actually see in front of him. He's going after this woman. But actually Samson here is the epitome of the whole book of Judges. This very action represents what everyone's doing. Literally, figuratively, they're just doing whatever they want, pursuing their own lusts. Whatever I think is right, well, that's just what I'm going to do. I'll do whatever I like. That's what he's willing to do. Thirdly, Samson is willing to hide things from his parents. That's verses 5 and 6. So verse 5, he goes down to Timnah with his parents, and we're told he comes to the vineyards of Timnah. Now, there is a question I think we should ask before we even carry on there, which is this. What's he even doing in a vineyard? Because he's a lifelong Nazarite. He can never drink wine. He's not allowed to even pluck the grapes and eat them. If he has fruit and fiber for breakfast, you know, he's got to pick out the raisins. He can't just eat them normally. You know, that's the sort of life he... So, does he really think he can waltz through this vineyard, a Canaanite vineyard with all these luscious grapes? And what's he doing there? It's foolish and unwise at best to put himself right next to the very thing he knows he can't touch. But there he is. He's in the vineyard. He must have got separated from his parents because there's a lion that comes roaring against him, but he's all alone. But we're told the power of the Spirit of God's with him and he's able to tear this lion apart. He's got no weapon. He just does it with his bare hands. But what I want you to notice, the little details, sometimes the things we don't pick up on. At the end of verse 6, we're told he doesn't tell his father or his mother what he's done. Why not? Why do you think that is? Because after all, he's not done anything wrong, has he? He didn't go out pursuing the lion. The lion suddenly appeared. It took him by surprise. It leapt on him. He's acting in self-defense. What choice does he have but to defend himself? And the Spirit of God came upon him. And so, you know, He's not really done anything wrong here, I don't think. So why doesn't he want to tell his parents? I think it must be for this reason. It must be because it was such a vivid reminder of what he'd been called to be. The power that he has to tear apart a lion, well, he only has that power because God is with him and God is calling him to this particular work of delivering Israel, to be this Nazarite figure. I think he probably knows if he tells his parents, they're going to be saying to him, remember your calling. Remember who you are. You're a Nazarite. Look at the power God's bestowed on you by the Holy Spirit. So why are you doing all this other stuff? Why are you going and pursuing this woman, this Philistine? Why are you living the way you live? I think he probably knows they are likely to challenge him, use that incident as a way of doing it. He's already brushed off one awkward conversation with them. He probably doesn't want another. You know, we can do that sometimes too. Sometimes there are things we think, I don't want to talk about such and such with that person. And do you know why we don't want to do that? It's because we feel that that person might challenge us. Might say, is that really right? Should you really be doing that? So we think, well, I just won't mention it at all. Do you know, that's a good question to ask yourself. If there's things we think, well, I wouldn't want to talk about this thing with that person, maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe your conscience there is telling you that actually that's because that thing is something you shouldn't be doing. Maybe that's a challenge for us to reassess. And you know, we've got to remember, I can avoid that person. I can avoid certain topics of conversation if I really want to. But it's a sign something's not right, and actually God still sees all those things. Let's carry on. Number four, Samson is willing to ignore God's laws and mislead his parents. I suppose it's 7 to 9. He carries on, he's determined to ignore his Nazarite calling. So in verse 7, he goes down, he talks with this woman, told she's pleasing to the eye. She pleased him well, that same phrase again. Verse 8, he then sees the carcass of the lion. And by this time, there's this community of bees that have made their home there, and they start producing honey. Again, question for you children. Any of you know a cartoon-type character who is a famous lover of honey? An old-fashioned... Go on. Winnie the Pooh. Thank you very much. Winnie the Pooh loves honey, doesn't he? And I've got a good Winnie the Pooh quote for you. Here's what Winnie the Pooh says about eating honey. He says, what I like best about honey, and then he had to stop and think, because although eating honey was a very good thing to do, there was a moment just before you began to eat it which was actually better than when you were eating it, but he didn't know what that moment was called. See what Winnie the Pooh likes? The anticipation of eating the honey. That's his favourite bit about honey, the bit where he's licking his lips and he's looking forward to it. And clearly Samson likes eating honey too. He takes it, he's presumably still in the honeycomb, he walks along the road, we're told, he's eating it. But you know what the problem is here? He's breaking his Nazarite calling again, because he's reached in and he's taken fruit from the carcass of a dead animal, something he's not allowed to touch. But just like the Philistine woman, he sees it, he wants it, he takes it. Again, he's a man driven entirely by his impulses. His mouth waters for something, he drools after it, so he goes and takes it. He takes this honey because that's what he wants, that's what he feels like having. And notice in verse 9, it makes it worse because he gives some to his parents, but again we're told he didn't tell them that it had actually come from the carcass of the lion. So he's making them unclean through his actions too. Samson here is just utterly blasé, not only about his own Nazarite calling, but about the implications of what he's doing to other people as well. Number 5, Samson is willing to feast with the enemy, verses 10 and 11. Seems to be some sort of Philistine custom that you'd go to the place of the bride and you'd have an extended feast at a time of marriage. But this isn't just feasting on food. When you read it in the original words, it's quite clear this is going to be an extended drinking session. Wine is going to be present in abundance at this feast. Did Samson drink wine there? We don't know. We're not told. But I think he probably did. We're not told he didn't. Seems quite likely. This is a long period of feasting that's going on here. Even if he didn't, he's joining in with this Philistine custom. He's eating with the enemy. And remember, these are the people God's called him to deliver Israel from. And here he is tucking into food, eating a barbecue or probably even a hog roast or something. You know, he's just dining, feasting with them. But Samson's willing to do that. Number six, Samson's willing to line his own pockets with a riddle. So verses 12 to 14. So verse 12, Samson offers them this challenge. He'll tell them the riddle, and if they solve it by the end of the feast, he'll give them 30 linen garments and sets of clothing. But if not, they'll have to give the same to him. Linen garments, basically another word for underwear. So, boys and girls, this would be like me saying to you, if you can solve my riddle, I'll give you 30 pairs of pants. Except that pants were a bit more valuable back then, so it was actually something a bit more worth trying to solve the riddle for. It's actually quite a big bet Samson's making. This is quite valuable stuff. So he tells them this riddle, and it's a riddle that you'll see somewhere. Here's what it says. Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. What food item would you see that on even today? You might have in your cupboards. Can you read that on something? Yeah, you know, because I told you. We had it this morning. Go on, Heather, where would you find it?
Golden syrup.
You'll find it on your tins of golden syrup. That same phrase, and you'll have the picture of the lion with the honey coming out of it. We looked at it just this morning when we had golden syrup with our porridge. Well, there you go. Samson, so far in this story, has been motivated by lust, then by honey, and now by money. That's what's occupying his brain. How can I take this situation and use it to my advantage to make money out of these Philistines? Well, I know, I'll tell a really difficult riddle and I'll get their money that way. That's what he thinks about. Number seven, Samson is willing to marry a woman he doesn't trust and then tell her a secret even though he doesn't trust her. Verses 15 to 17. So these men, when they can't work out the riddle, they put pressure on his wife. They say they're going to burn her. They're going to burn her father's house down. This is serious stuff. She doesn't know the answer, though. So she has to put pressure on her husband, Samson. She says, if you really loved me, you'd tell me. He says in verse 16, look, I've not told anyone, even my parents. That's the implication, is if I was to tell anyone, my parents would be the first to know, but I've not even told them yet. But verse 17, eventually she does get the answer from him. But you notice what he's doing here. He's marrying someone that he doesn't trust, that he wouldn't be willing to tell the secret to because he won't trust her with it. And then with her, she clearly doesn't trust him either because she's not prepared to just come straight up to him and say, hey, Samson, we've got a problem here. I'm being threatened. My life is in danger, but will you help me? She uses tactics. There's no friendship. There's no relationship here. So in fact, when the men come and they tell Samson the answer to the riddle, he says in verse 18, if you had not ploughed my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. In other words, you just wormed your way into my wife's heart. You used her to get at me. Just a little marriage tip for you men out there, and this one's for free. It's never a good idea to call your wife a heifer, okay? It never works out well. The meaning here in this one is just as bad when Samson's doing it. The translation doesn't make it any better or worse. It is that bad. That's what he's doing. It's not a compliment. That's what he talks about his wife. And number eight, Samson is willing to kill to pay for his lost bet. That's verses 19 and 20. He goes down to Ashkelon. He kills 30 men. He takes their clothes. He pays what he owes. And then he goes back to his house. He doesn't decide he'll work extra hard and try and find the money or anything like that. No, that's what he does. And verse 20, the story ends with his wife being given to a companion. It says best man, but really, I mean, it's using the word like friend here, but we do want inverted commas here, because these are just people who turned up at the feast, who were brought to accompany him, but They're not his friends. There's no loyalty here because his wife's given away to someone else. I don't know about you. I don't think Samson comes across terribly well in Judges 14. He's totally devoted to one person, himself. He pursues whatever it is he wants. He's motivated by lust, by greed, by instant gratification. He's insolent, he's disrespectful to his parents, he's callous to his Nazarite calling, he's disloyal to the Israelite people, he's rude to his wife. You know, you've got this whole string of things he's done. And yet this is the man God's chosen to deliver Israel. So what's going on there? Well, this is what I think is happening in this chapter. Samson is a man on the run from God. This is just like Jonah. I would say it's Jonah all over again, but he comes before Jonah. This is Jonah trying to flee from God's demands, from his presence. Jonah thinks he can actually run from God. If he flees it all the way over there, maybe he'll escape that way. Samson seems to just think he can live as he pleases, and that whole pesky Nazarite business, well, it'll all just go away. Maybe God will go and find someone else instead. Because after all, no, I didn't choose to be a Nazarite. Nobody asked me. This is something that was imposed on him before he was born. He had no choice in the matter at all. So I thought, well, that's not fair, is it? Why do I have to be the one who doesn't get to drink wine and eat grapes? And I have to let my hair grow long and I have to do all this, you know, I have to engage in this holy war. Why me? I didn't sign up for it. But Samson is so different to all the other Nazarites for that reason, that he's a lifelong Nazarite from his birth. He never agreed to it like all the other Nazarites do in the Bible. I think there's one big lesson for us in this chapter. Here's the one big lesson for us. If you're a Christian, we're called to consciously decide, will you embrace your calling or will you run from it? Now, I'm not talking here about things you can change in your life. Rather, I'm talking about all the things in your life that actually you didn't choose, but they're just, they're there. They're in your life. It's not where you had several different options and this is the one you chose. I'm not talking about things you can necessarily change. There are just things God has called you to, which you didn't choose in your life. You know, it starts, even when you're children, you know. Sometimes you don't get to choose who you sit next to in the classroom. And sometimes you get put next to people you don't want to sit next to, and the teacher might even say, no, you need to stay there. You didn't choose that seat, but that's where you are. It carries on that way through life with so many things. None of us chose our families, did we? None of us chose who our parents would be, and that's who we're placed in those families. God has given you the family he's given you. You didn't choose those people. You didn't select them. You didn't choose to be ill, did you? No one ever chooses to be ill. No one ever chooses to have physical constraints and to wake up in the night with pain and suffering. But you are where you are now, and you can't heal yourself. You didn't choose it, but this is where you are today. You didn't choose to get stuck in a job you don't enjoy. But yes, I know sometimes you can change your job, but sometimes you can't. You are where you are. You're in your job. You've tried to find something new and you can't. And you've come to realise, this is just the job I have to be in for now. You didn't choose to be single. But nevertheless, that's just how life has panned out. It was never a conscious choice, but well, here I am. I'm single now at this point in my life. You look at some of your emotional frailties, you think that this just seems to be how God made me. This is just something about who I am. And well, this isn't a call for indifference or for apathy, you know, the que sera, sera, whatever will be, you know, if you can find a better job, you go for it. If you can change things and so on, well, we change it. that, you know, there are so many things in our lives that we can't change. And when that's the case, that's when we've got to be ready to say, that must mean God himself has placed me in this situation at this moment in time, and he's done it for a reason. And the call for us with those things, if you're a Christian, is to embrace that calling that God has placed on you today. You know, Samson isn't willing to do that. You know, Samson could have said, I would never have chosen this. I didn't sign up to be a Nazarite. It's not what I wanted in my life, but God's called me to it. So I'll embrace it, and I'll honour it, and I'll live it out because he will be glorified through it. If you're a Christian, embrace your calling. This is where God's placed you right now. And we can very quickly look at other people's callings. Well, I could handle that one. I could deal with what they're going through. Remember what the Peter in John 21 sort of points to one of the other disciples. He said, Lord, what about him? Do you remember the Lord Jesus' response there? He says, what is that to you? You follow me. So that's our calling. To follow him, even in the circumstances that we have no control over. The things that we'd love to change. It's like the Apostle Paul with his thorn in the flesh. And he asks the Lord, will you remove it from me? And when the answer comes back, no. Well, Paul has to simply to embrace his calling. To trust that the grace of God will be sufficient for him. Because God's placed him there. He's given him that thorn in the flesh for a reason. And Samson fails with that. And if we're honest, there are times when we fail with that too. There are times when we will become bitter and resentful and say, why does it have to be me, Lord? Why can't it be someone else in this situation? Why can't you give me another burden to carry instead? Actually, when we cross that line into being bitter and resentful, maybe that's how you realise that you are tonight. Well, actually, that means we need to repent of that. We need to turn back away from that way of thinking. And as we do that, the good news is that we have a Saviour who did embrace his calling fully and totally. Now, Jesus' calling was far more serious, far more sobering, far more agonising a call than we will ever come to terms with in this world. Do you know where Samson keeps on pursuing his own desires? And I think we can see something of ourselves in Samson. With Jesus, his whole life is dedicated to pursuing his children, to living a perfect life, dying for us, never distracted by the alluring things of this world, whether it's food or drink or money or power. At every point, Jesus pursues his holy calling. As we said last week, Jesus is the perfect, the true Nazarite, the one set aside for a holy calling to do God's will. What's so amazing for us, though, is you read a chapter like that, you think, God still used Samson, in spite of all those things. There's a couple of verses we haven't touched on, but if you look at verse 6, we've left this till the end, we're told in verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson. That's how he can tear the lion apart. It's there in verse 19 again. It's God's Spirit who enables him to go down and kill those 30 men. God is going to use Samson in spite of his foolish, arrogant, impulsive, disobedient behaviour. What a comforting thought that is. Because if God restricted himself to only using people with perfect, pure motives, well, I don't think any of us would qualify, would we? God uses Samson. And he uses him. Yeah, that's possible because Jesus embraced his calling. So just as Jesus embraced his calling, we are to embrace the calling God's given us today as well. We're going to sing a hymn now which is about Jesus's calling, a hymn that focuses on the cross and what was happening there. So we're going to stand and sing "See the Destined Day Arise" to help us think about what it meant for Jesus to embrace that calling. So we'll stand and sing this.